funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Stephen Becker in for Chris Boyd. When you hear the name Nolan Ryan, the first things that come to mind are numbers. 5,000 strikeouts, 7 no-hitters, 300 wins, and maybe most impressive of all, 27 seasons in the big leagues. My guest today first met Ryan as a bat boy for the California Angels during Ryan's playing days with the club in the early 70s. And since then, they've kept in touch, which has led to a new definitive biography on the baseball legend. Rob Goldman's book is called Nolan Ryan, The Making of a Pitcher. Rob, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks, Stephen. Appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, thank you for being here. So Ryan grew up in the small Texas town of Alvin, which is outside of Houston. And I think some people might be surprised to know that had things gone differently, he might have turned into a basketball star.
Well, either that or a veterinarian. Actually, you're right. His favorite sport was basketball. He was a star forward for the Alvin High School team, and he actually had colleges talking to him. And it wasn't until his sophomore year in high school that he really got involved with the baseball program there. And had he not stumbled upon the diamond, he might have been a good college basketball player or probably eventually would turn into a good veterinarian.
Was there a moment early on that made him decide that baseball was really probably his way in life?
Well, he never took things for granted, even as a kid, and he was never really sure. You got to realize, even with his skill, his talent, his arm, you know, he threw 100 miles per hour in high school. But, you know, back then it wasn't like everybody knew about you. We didn't have the scouting system we have now, and there wasn't the internet, or, you know, not everybody knew about Nolan Ryan. In fact, he pretty much got buried out there. There was one scout in particular, Red Murph from the Mets, and he caught on to it. But really, he could have slipped through the cracks. And, there was a day it was interesting the way that he was discovered by his high school coach. They had a softball toss on the football field he was a sophomore. He wasn't yet on the baseball team. And he took the softball as like a 14-year-old kid and threw it the entire length of the field. 300 feet. And the coach, Jim Watson, says, "You're coming out for baseball right now." And, you know, he took him out there, and Watson faced him. You know, he got up to the plate, and I think Nolan hit him a couple times. But he saw this. He was the first guy to really see the speed and the dominance that he had, even as a kid. And from there, he got on the team. But it took years for him to find his groove. He never got his control, even with the Mets. It took 6 years there. It wasn't until the Angels in 1972. So it was a long, hard grind. There was never one defining moment. Well, this is where I'm going to be a pitcher. I'm going to be the great Nolan Ryan. It wasn't that way. It was a hard, hard grind, and it took a lot of trial and error, and it took a lot of perseverance, and it took some support from Ruth Ryan as well.
Yeah, you mentioned Ruth, and they met as teenagers, and of course they would eventually get married, and they're still married today. And obviously she's had a huge impact on his life, but how do you think she affected his playing career?
Well, it's interesting. Ruth and Nolan, they have similar values. They both believe in the golden rule. They're both family-oriented. They're both great athletes. Actually, Ruth was probably more acclaimed in high school than Nolan almost. She was a great tennis player, and she was going to go to she had college offers, but she decided on marrying Nolan instead. Without Ruth Ryan, I don't think that we'd have Nolan Ryan as we know today. She was there, like you said, they married right after high school. She was just a kid, and they stuck it out through some real tough times in the minor leagues. And they're very unique people. They're very loyal. They're very, like I said, they believe in the golden rule. You know, they honor the vows, the wedding vows. And there was times early on, Stephen, where, you know, no one wanted to quit. He wasn't cutting it with the Mets. He wanted out of New York. He was frustrated with the training he was getting with New York, and he wasn't starting. He was buried in the bullpen, and he says, "If we don't get out of here, I'm going to quit and, you know, go back to college and become a vet." But Ruth said, "No, let's stick it out. Let's see what happens." And that's when he requested the trade and ended up with the Angels. And then with the Angels in 1972, his first season there, there was a strike that spring, and the Ryans were basically broke. And they had the infant baby Reed on board, and he wasn't making any money, and he was frustrated with the Angels at that time. He wasn't cutting it there either. And he said, look, if this goes on another week, I'm going to quit. And Ruth again said, no, let's stick it out. Let's just see how this goes. We worked this hard to get this far, and let's stick it out. So Ruth Ryan is instrumental, and throughout her career, you know, they had a really unique relationship. He'd call her up to 4 or 5 times a day on the road, always checking in, wondering what was going on. And he wasn't a typical ball player. He wouldn't chase. He wouldn't drink. But he remained loyal to Ruth, a very, very special person. She was really the driver behind him and kept the home fires burning.
So as you mentioned, Ryan was drafted by the New York Mets out of high school. We should note the 226th player taken overall that year. And when he made it to the big leagues in 1966, the first time as a 19-year-old, he joined a team that was really full of basically washed-up old guys. And seeing those guys hanging around in the clubhouse kind of shaped the way he approached his career. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that was September of 66 he was brought up. You know, the thing is, he never got quality time in the minor leagues. They fast-tracked Nolan because of his ability. And the Mets had nothing back then. They needed a star, somebody to gravitate with, so they rushed him through the minors. He never even played AAA. So he gets there in September of 66. And he's greeted by a bunch of jaded veterans who they resent him because they feel that he's going to take their spots. Nobody even talked to him. The manager was Wes Westrum. He greeted him. He was stark naked, shook his hand, and said, "Welcome aboard, Nolan." So, you know, and there's a bunch of cigar-smoking jaded vets around, and, you know, he was pretty lonely out there. And you got to realize when Shea Stadium, you know, it held 50,000 people. Alvin, Texas has about 15,000 people. So it was a mind-blowing experience, and he didn't fare well that first year. His first batter was Pat Jarvis, the Atlanta Braves pitcher. He struck him out, and then he got a few guys. For the next inning, Joe Torre hit his best fastball over the scoreboard, and that was like, okay, I can no longer just bury guys in my fastball. I got to work on things, and it was an eye-opening experience. He definitely needed more work. Like I said, the Mets fast-tracked him, and he just didn't get the quality training that he needed.
And another thing that made things tough when he was playing for the Mets was that he was also busy fulfilling his military obligation, because this was during the Vietnam War. How'd that work, and how did that affect his career?
Well, back then, if you get drafted, which no one did, you know, most of these kids got sent right overseas to Vietnam, and a lot of them didn't come back. A lot of his classmates didn't. But the Mets had a deal where, you know, you get drafted, they could put you on the reserve list. And back then, it was like once a month for 2 weekends, you go to military camp, which is not good for if you're a struggling pitcher, because pitching is all about a routine, you know, fundamentals, mechanics, you know, finding your pace. And every time he'd get it, he'd have to go out, you know, some camp, military camp in North Carolina or Texas or someplace, and get thrown off. So that didn't help the cause. And plus, the Mets at that time, they had a lot of young, fireballing young guys, the Tom Seaver, Jerry Kuzman, Jim McAndrew, Gary Gentry. They all threw 93, 94 plus. And, you know, he just got out of sync there, and he couldn't get back. And Gil Hodges was not a patient guy with him, the manager, and he kind of threw him in the bullpen, and he couldn't get out of there. And that's pretty much his 5 or 6 years with the Mets. It was not an easy road. He had no fundamentals from lack of minor league time, and they had no real pitching coach that would really help him.
So, as you said, he was on the Mets for about 6 seasons, and he was even on their World Series team in 69. But it wasn't until he was traded to the California Angels that his career really took off. Was it just the change of scenery, or what was it that helped him really establish himself once he got to the West Coast?
Well, there was more than that. You know, there was moments of brilliance with New York, but he just, like I said, because of those elements, he couldn't figure it out. So he goes to the California Angels, which in 1972 they were doormats. They had nothing going on there either, but that turned out to be a blessing in disguise, because the Angels, they traded a highly touted shortstop, Jim Fregosi, for Ryan. At the time, everyone said, why would you trade Fregosi for Ryan? So it was very, seemed like it was one-sided. But when he got to California, there was the pitching coach, and this is what Nolan says probably the most help he ever had was from this individual named Tom Morgan, a former New York Yankee pitcher, and he was the first guy with some intelligence to really work with Nolan. You know, he put him on the sideline, he got his he straightened out his mechanics. He worked and worked and worked and worked, and then we also had a conditioning coach named Jimmy Reese, who worked and worked and worked with Nolan. And also Nolan, many people know this, he stumbled upon a universal gym, which, you know, the old school weight training, weight machine, early on in 1972, and he figured out that he could go longer every game by using weights, which was revolutionary at the time, and also taboo. If the general manager had found out, he probably would have, you know, fined him. But because California had no pitching, and they had no team, and they had no superstar, Nolan was allowed the time to learn what he needed to learn years ago. And boy, when he got it together, when he finally got his mechanics lined up, he dominated. Everything that everybody thought he was going to be with the Mets but didn't happen with Anaheim in a relatively short time. And in that first year, he struck out 329 batters and won 19 games on a sub-500 team. And it was obvious that Nolan Ryan was on the road to being a superstar.
And you mentioned that was also around the time that he sort of discovered the weight room and started training, and that really was pretty revolutionary. We kind of take it for granted that athletes train all the time now, but that wasn't the case back in those days.
No, it wasn't. Back then, no one lifted weights, not even, you know, the starters, not, you know, pitching. It was absolutely taboo to lift weights. They felt it would tighten you up, and it would throw you off completely. But Nolan has an innate curiosity. He had it even back then. And, I'll tell you the story. He was stumbling around the corridors of Anaheim Stadium one night, and we had a soccer team playing there, old Continental League, and it's long extinct. And they had stuck one of those old-school weight machines in one of the storage areas. Nolan just stumbled upon it, and he started playing around with it. You know, he did a little bench press, he did a little curling, did the lats, but he really focused on his legs, which were already huge. And he discovered that by lifting weights, he became looser, and also he got stronger after the seventh inning. And if anybody you ever talked to who faced Nolan Ryan, he was faster as the game went longer. So that was the first initial contact that pitchers have with weights. And believe me, word gets around quick. So when Nolan Ryan's lifting weights, all of a sudden everybody else starts lifting weights. In a matter of time, every major league clubhouse had a weight room. But also, what people don't know, he discovered stretching in 1973. The manager, Bobby Winkles, brought this strength coach from unpaid strength coach, a hippie guy out of Long Beach State, over to Anaheim Stadium to introduce his players to stretching. Winkles was a former coach at Arizona State, so he knew about stretching, but the major leagues didn't. And he brought the guy on the sideline and invited anybody who wanted to come out to start stretching, and Nolan was one of those guys. And next thing you know, Nolan, who's got huge calves and huge legs, he's putting his leg over his neck. He was doing all these outrageous stretching. And when you combine that kind of strength with weights, with conditioning, and now you got stretching going on, you're going to have a lean machine that could really, really do some damage. And so not only did he revolutionize the weights for pitcher, he revolutionized stretching, and later on in Houston and Texas, you know, running in a pool and intense workouts. So he is a bit of a revolutionary when it comes to conditioning.
We're talking today with Rob Goldman about his book, Nolan Ryan, The Making of a Pitcher. You can join the conversation or share your favorite memories of watching Ryan pitch by calling 800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Stephen Becker, and for Chris Boyd. And our guest today is Rob Goldman. We're talking about his book, Nolan Ryan, The Making of a Pitcher. So, Rob, we're certainly not going to go year by year through Ryan's career. That would take a while. But I did want to spend a little time on the 1973 season, which is just one of the most statistically incredible seasons a pitcher has ever had. Can you tell me a little bit about that year?
Yeah, Stephen, you're right. You hit that on the head. And by the way, he didn't get the Cy Young Award that year. Jim Palmer did.
Right, which will blow people away once we hear about just all that he accomplished that year.
Which goes to tell you there's some East Coast bias. And also, you got to remember, back then there was no ESPN, so no one saw the Angels. They were not a featured team. So Nolan Ryan was basically a secret. So that's one of the reasons why he didn't get the limelight that maybe he would have had in this in today's game. But anyway, yeah, like we talked about, 73, everything came together. The weights took the full effect. He no longer had to sneak in the weight room. He was stretching regularly. He didn't have to worry about paying his bills because he had a $100,000 contract. He was able to relax. He knew finally he had broken through, and he was able to relax a little bit. And that year, the Angels had a new manager, Bobby Winkles, and was very pro-Ryan and very pro-conditioning, and things really broke out. In May of that year, he threw his first no-hitter against Kansas City. In July of that, a couple months later, he threw his second no-hitter, which might have been his most dominating game against Detroit. But most interestingly that year was, we call it the countdown in the book. In 1963, Sandy Koufax struck out 382 people, players, and Ryan got off to a bang, and he was on track the whole year to break Sandy's record. So it got pretty exciting, you know, August, September, you know, they started keeping track, you know, comparisons of Nolan and Sandy, which brought a lot of more people to the fans and a lot more attention to Ryan, and this went down right to the wire. Prior to the last game he was going to pitch that year in September, he needed 17 strikeouts to break the record. Now, there's a chance he could have gone again, but he knew that, you know, he's going to have one shot at it. It was against the Minnesota Twins that night, and he got off to a rocky start, but by the second inning, he struck out the side, and he was, in the ninth inning, he was one away from the record. But he had thrown so hard, he'd thrown over 170 pitches. And he was throwing so hard, he started becoming, he depleted of his fluids, and he was getting dehydrated. He started cramping up. Now, this game went into extra innings. You know, they didn't win in nine innings, and he still needed that one strikeout. So the manager Winkles had a decision to make. You know, do I take a risk on blowing out Nolan's arm and really hurting him, or do I let him get the record? And he asked Nolan, you know, after the ninth inning, what do you want me to do? He says, keep me in, Skip. And he pitched him a ninth. He didn't get it. But now he was really hurting. The trainer, Freddie Federico, noticed he was really fatigued. So they called down Doc Rosinski from the press box, and Doc came down. And in between innings, in between the ninth and the tenth, they had him in the corner of the dugout, rubbing it was like a prize fighter's corner. They were rubbing his legs to get the cramps out. They were flushing fluids down him with salt tablets, which was really a no-no. But that just shows you the perseverance. And that really pointed out the year. That was really Nolan's year. He persevered. That game epitomized his year. And they got him back out there on the 10th. He couldn't strike anybody out. But the 11th inning with two outs, he got Rich Reese for his 383rd strikeout and broke the record. And interestingly, Winkles kept asking him, do you want to go out? Give me one more. And Winkles said after the 11th, that would have been it. He ended up throwing almost 200 pitches. But that epitomized the year of 1973. Like I said, he won 22 games. But, you know, Jim Palmer, the Orioles won the division, and, you know, he got all the limelight. But he threw two no-hitters, broke Sandy Koufax's season strikeout record, and he didn't win the Cy Young Award. But 1973 year was the breakout year for Nolan Ryan.
Yeah, not only that, he didn't even make the All-Star team that year.
Yeah.
What does a guy have to do?
Well, yeah, and he had... He already had his no-hitter. I guess the second no-hitter was after the All-Star. It might have been just before it. But, you know, like I said, Stephen, not everybody knew about him. It was pre-ESPN. The Angels televised 20 games a year, you know. And mm-hmm. the West Coast, the scores don't get back to the East Coast till 3 in the morning or 12, you know. So they don't even report him. But he kind of got buried back here. It wasn't until 1979 that he really, you know, people started taking notice of him.
So this is obviously, though, around the time when at least people within baseball began to fear Ryan, particularly hitters. And you tell a kind of a funny story in the book about when a player named Norm Cash came to bat against Ryan. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, well, they called it Ryanitis. That was the name of it, when you know, major league stars would suddenly pull up lame and get scratched from the starting lineup. And, you know, I never seen a guy, I was there 20 feet away, and I never seen guys buckle like, you know, like he did, like they did on a curveball. But anyway, Norm Cash, the story you're referring to, was his second no-hitter in July of 1973. Norm's a real character. And, he, you know, him and Nolan were tight. I think they went hunting a couple times. But Nolan was so overpowering that day. He'd struck out 17 Tigers by the seventh inning there. So, and they knew it. They just couldn't hit him. And Norm Cash, he came in his last at bat. Nolan needed a final out for the no hitter, and you know, like I said, he's a character. What Norm did, there's a spread table in the clubhouse. He ripped off one of the legs of the spread table. He took it out instead of bringing up his bat. He brought up the table leg, and he actually brought it up to the plate. And the umpire, you know. Nolan saw it first and flagged down the home plate. Umpire Ron Luciano says, "Hey, look what he's got!" And everyone started laughing, including Nolan. And but that was, and then you know, Norm threw the table leg out, and halfway got him a new bat, and he popped up to Rudy Maioli at short for the final out. But that goes to show you what kind of I don't know if it's respect or what kind of fear. They just gave up. They just couldn't hit him, and Norm took it to another level that day.
So one of the numbers that Ryan's also famous for is $1 million, and that's how many dollars per year the Houston Astros paid him to leave the Angels in 1979, and that number is significant as well.
Yeah, that's an interesting story because that's the first time that a ball player broke the $1 million mark. I think it was the second time a pro athlete did. Back then, $1 million was a lot of money.
That's a lot of money today.
Well, some of these guys are getting $20
million. Yeah, I guess it's all relative, right?
But, you know, back then it was a big deal. You know, and I think the Angels' final offer was $500,000. And, you know, he went to free agency after the Angels basically, you know, they didn't acknowledge him, and so he said, "Well, I'm going to go to free agency." And yeah, sure enough, everybody was on it, and Houston wanted him. He was a local guy, and they said, "Well, here's $1 million." And okay, well, I'm in Houston, and you know, it turned out pretty good for him, but it turned out really bad for the Angels. But yeah, he was the first $1 million man, and the problem with that, they kept him to that $1 million level for his entire 9 years with Houston, and by the time he left, Joe Niekro and Jim Deshays, they were making more than he was. You know, I think Niekro was making a couple million, and he asked for a raise just to, you know, kind of keep up with the Joneses, and they said no. And he said, "Well, okay, I guess I'll try the free agent market." And they said, "Well, go ahead." And again, someone took him for granted, and the Rangers, you know, jumped on it, and so did a bunch of other teams, and he ended up and with the Rangers for even more money. But, yeah, he was the first $1 million man.
So when both Astros and Rangers fans go to their respective ballparks, they see Ryan's familiar number 34 retired. But for the first half of his career, Ryan wore number 30. So why did he make the switch, and how did he end up on 34?
Yeah, Nolan's got three retired numbers, Angels number 30, and, of course, 34 with the Rangers in Houston. Well, you know, Nolan's... he's not big at stats. He's not big at, you know, he's just not, he doesn't get tied into that stuff. And, you know, when he got into Houston, Kevin Bass, a young player, outfielder, he already had number 30. And the equipment man says, "Well, I'll give you number 30. Kevin won't mind." He said, no. You know, no one was thinking back when he was a kid and how bad he would have felt if someone took his number. He said, "Well, let him keep his number." And he says, Who's number 34 in Houston? Akeem Olajuwon and then 34 was also the number of the great halfback you had. What was his name?
Yeah. Earl Campbell.
Earl
right?
Campbell. So mm-hmm. Why don't we just go with 34? That sounds like a pretty good number. So that's how he got 34, because Kevin Bass had number 30.
And along those lines, can you talk about how he got the nickname the Ryan Express?
Yeah, back in 1972 when he was taking off, around that time there was a Frank Sinatra movie called Van Sydow's or something Van Sydow's Express, something Von Ryan's Express. There was a big movie out, and we had a beat writer named Dick Miller, and he got wind of that name and Ryan through like a freight train, so Ryan Express. So that's how that came about. That was 1972. That was courtesy of Dick Miller, our beat writer that year.
So as we mentioned, you got to know Nolan a little bit as a bat boy for the Angels, but you actually met him a few years earlier. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, when I was a kid, I was one of those kids who just ate, drank, and lived baseball. And in 1968, my dad took me to the Astrodome to watch the All-Star game. And we didn't know it. We stumbled in the same hotel as the players, the Shamrock Hilton. And I walk in there, and there's Tony Perez and Willie Mays and Hank Aaron. And I was in hog heaven. I was buying postcards and little baseballs and get signed. And that just solidified my interest in the game. And then the following year, my dad died in the spring. And my mom, being a great mom, she wanted to fulfill, maybe some of the roles that he played. So she asked me, what do you want to do this year? Do you want to take a special trip? And she says, yeah, I want to go back to the Shamrock Hilton and meet some baseball players. So we picked the Mets because they had just won the World Championship in 1969. And so I'm sitting around the lobby just rehashing what I did in the 68 All-Star game. And, I had one ball. I was getting everybody on it. And by the third day, I had everybody on it but Nolan. And I just thought, where's Nolan Ryan? I couldn't find him. I couldn't. I needed to have him to complete the ball because he was a named player. And I asked one of the players, he lives in Alvin, so he doesn't hang out here. And he might be around here on getaway day, but he won't be here the other days. So being kind of an industrious little kid, I told the bellhop, I'm Nolan Ryan's cousin. Can you give me his room number? And he gave me his room number, and I went upstairs and knocked on the door with my baseball, and there was Ruth Ryan entering, welcoming me like I'm a long lost friend. And Nolan's in the back in his suit, and he invited me in and talked a little bit and signed my stuff. And again, I'm in hog heaven. But that was my first meeting with the Ryans, and I was struck even then by their kindness and their empathy towards a kid. And I just felt real good around him, and a couple of years later, I was hired as a bat boy in spring training, and that's when the friendship really started to flourish.
So, do you still have that ball around somewhere?
It's there.
I bet.
Got it. And prized memento, and the memory's even better though.
So Nolan is obviously known for, throwing 100 miles an hour and just having this rocket right arm, but he was also able to develop quite a mental advantage over hitters. Can you talk about the ways that he was able to intimidate the guys he was facing?
Yeah, for one thing, he had that magic right arm, but, he had to work with it. It didn't come overnight, like we talked about. His career is by design. It wasn't some fluke thing. And you're right. As much as his physical prowess, he had to develop an intense mindset. When you meet Nolan Ryan, he's the kindest, most nicest guy off the field. On the field, everybody is his enemy. That's what Don Sanders told me, his business partner in Round Rock. And no one had to condition himself to be mean and tough, because by nature he isn't. And that took discipline and concentration. And he said to me once in an interview, he said, yeah, I don't miss that at all. I don't want to ever go back to that kind of level of concentration and intimidation, because, it took work. It was against his nature. But, boy, you're exactly right, Stephen. He had three pitches. He had a curveball. He had two pitches. He had a curveball and he had a fastball. And then he eventually had a changeup. But he also had another pitch, and that was intimidation, which he called Texas bow ties. He got that from Satchel Paige. He wasn't afraid to throw inside. He knew he could do damage up high, but, If somebody needed to be hit, he'd hit him.
Yeah, I mean, and back in those days, and even today, that was sort of part of being a good teammate. I mean, for people who don't follow baseball, there's this code in the game that basically says if another team's pitcher hits one of your guys, then you've got to go out there and hit one of theirs. And he was more than happy to do that.
Yeah, there was no questions asked. It was expected. And if you didn't do it, you know, if you didn't have your teammates' backs, they'd look down on you. The problem with Nolan doing it, you know, you're throwing 100 miles an hour, you could do some damage. But once the play, you know, he was wild anyway. When you're throwing that hard, you're going to be wild. But, you know, once players realize that, you know, you might get a Texas bow tie if you get a little cocky, if you lean into the pitch. You know, he had a philosophy, the inside of the plate's mine, you know, take your chances. If you're gonna lean across the plate and try to hit it to right field, you're gonna get one. Or you're gonna if you're gonna bunt on me, you're gonna get one. If you mess up one of my teammates, you're gonna get one. And that was part of his philosophy, and that's how he got in trouble with the Robin Ventura deal, because he kept hitting White Sox who were leaning outside for the outside pitch. But that's another story. But
yeah,
you're right. The mental ability, the concentration, the focus, that had to come. That wasn't natural. It had to come from work, from discipline and work, and that's a real good point you made.
Yeah, and he eventually probably got a little better at control, but that wildness, you know, when the hitters know that he has a tendency to be wild, that can get in the back of your head too.
Definitely, and that's where Ryanitis came from. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you know, people told me, you know, equipment manager of the A's said, yeah, guys would just, you know, they'd show up scared, they'd show up sick, and they took themselves out of the lineup. He was that overwhelming. And once he got the curveball down and the changeup, you know, he's basically unhittable if he kept the ball down.
We're talking today with Rob Goldman about his book, Nolan Ryan, The Making of a Pitcher. When we come back, we're going to move along to the Texas Rangers years. You can join our conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or email us at think@kera.org. We'll be back with more from Rob Goldman after a short break.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Stephen Becker in for Chris Boyd. Our guest today is Rob Goldman, and we're talking about his book, Nolan Ryan, The Making of a Pitcher. So, Rob, in 1989, Ryan headed up I-45 to join the Rangers, and it's pretty hard to underestimate the effect that he had on the franchise from day one.
Well, again, Stephen, like the Angels, the Rangers had a history of basically nothing. They were not winners. They had no big names. There was nothing electric about the Texas Rangers in 1989.
Yeah, as a teenager living here in 1989, I can confirm your assessment of the team.
Yeah, you know, Joe Lovito. You know, I mean, who knows these guys? I mean, there's a list of no names they had. So that was one of the reasons why, you know, Texas wanted him so bad. And when the Houston Astros blanked and they, you know, they said go ahead and test the free market, the general manager Tom Greve, he jumped on it. He said, "Oh my goodness, are they serious?" Because, you know, people knew the value of Nolan Ryan. You know, Greve had already scouted Nolan, and the scout came back and said he's got one of the best arms in baseball still. So it wasn't just a publicity stunt. You know, this guy could still pitch, and the Rangers jumped on it. They outbid Gene Autry, who was frustrated about losing them the first time. He wanted him back, and you know he would have offered more money. But this is interesting. Ruth Ryan was very instrumental at this point. You know, Nolan had considered going back to Anaheim, but Ruth said, "No, I don't want to pull up the family again. Let's stay in Texas if we can." And so she was very instrumental in Nolan signing that 1-year contract with an option in 1989. And boy, What happened here, it was very interesting. I always said that no one gravitated to the smartest person in the room, whether it was a Tom Morgan or a conditioning coach like Gene Coleman in Houston. Texas at the time had a fellow named Tom House as pitching coach, and he was on the cutting edge of things. He'd come back from Japan, and he knew about all the new techniques, how throwing off the mound and, towel drills and different things, long toss. And him and no one had a great, they started a great relationship. Tom's a former California hippie professor, but no one's a down-home Texan, but somehow they hit it off. And when Tom got hold of Nolan in spring training, he found out through his computer technique that Nolan had dropped his arm 2 inches. He lifted his arm up 2 inches when he pitched, and he added 3 miles per hour to his fastball. The next thing you know, Nolan's back in the 1970s again. He's throwing, close to 100 miles an hour. And he got off to a bang. He just dominated hitters, and all of a sudden, the Texas Rangers had one of the best pitchers in baseball, even at 42, 43 years old. And for Texas, for the Ranger fans, it was just huge. He threw his 5,000th strikeout that year, got his 300th win. And that's when he came over to the Rangers, that's when we got he became the legend that we know. Before that, he was just a very good pitcher, great pitcher, but he became a legend when he became a Texas Ranger.
Yeah, he actually pitched, I think, the fewest number of seasons for the Rangers than any of the teams that he played for. And yet, in a lot of ways, I think he's most closely associated with the Rangers. In fact, the picture of him on the cover of your book is him in a Rangers uniform. So why is that? I think maybe it's, like you said, partly to do because of all the records that he accomplished while here?
Because everything came together. By that time, ESPN was on board, and people, and plus he's over 40 years old. All of a sudden, you couldn't ignore him anymore. He's over 40 years old. He's throwing 2 no-hitters, leading the major leagues in strikeouts in 1989. I mean, how do you do that? It's unprecedented. How are you 43, 44, 45 years old and still be able to do this? And all of a sudden, that's when the Advil commercials came, and he became the Nolan Ryan, the legend. But you're right. He played 9 years with Houston. He played 8 years with the Angels, and he played 5 years with the Rangers. Go figure. But we remember Nolan Ryan as a Texas Ranger, and I guess it's a marketing thing. That's why they wanted him on the cover of my book. I would have preferred the Angels, but you're right. Yeah, he's known as having that Texas across his chest. And but he did accomplish some incredible things here. It was just... he had already done a lot of things before that.
And there's an argument that could be made that the current ballpark that the Rangers play in could really be called the house that Ryan built, even though he actually never played there.
That's true. At the time, a couple years into his career at Texas, George W. Bush came on board, and he was a go-getter, and he realized that to build interest in Texas Rangers, they need a new ballpark. You guys played at this old minor league stadium, Arlington Stadium. I don't know if anybody remembers that. It was just, there was no shade. It was just a round circle. It was pretty primitive. And, you couldn't charge very much for tickets. So George Bush got behind an initiative, and he got some votes, and all of a sudden they broke ground for a new stadium. Now, that wouldn't have happened. According to John Blake, the Texas Ranger, current Texas Ranger PR man, that wouldn't happen without Nolan bringing interest to the Texas Rangers. It definitely wouldn't have happened. We state that specifically in the book. So thanks to George Bush and Nolan Ryan, you guys got a spanking new ballpark. And you're right. Nolan never got to enjoy it, but he's definitely responsible for them building it.
So once Nolan retired after the 1993 season, he was baseball's all-time leader for strikeouts with 5,714. He had 7 no-hitters. How much do you think he cared about those statistics?
He's, like I said before, he's not a big numbers guy. In fact, he didn't even know. Interesting story, back in the early 80s, Don Sutton, who pitched for the Astros, said, "Hey, you're close to 300 wins. You get 300 wins, you get in the Hall of Fame." And Nolan did some research, and he saw Walter Johnson and all these guys with 300 wins. So he wasn't sophisticated that way. He didn't count. He didn't count the stats. He didn't even know who the old players were. But he learned as he went along, and he let other people do the counting. And in fact, I asked him, what means more to you, the 383, the numbers? And he says the no-hitters meant the most to him because it was a team effort. That's what he remembers most. He says he remembers the camaraderie the most and the record second.
Are those numbers, particularly the strikeout and no-hitter figures, are those numbers you think will ever be surpassed?
You know, I will never say never because someone broke Lou Gehrig's consecutive game streak. You know, everything gets broken eventually. But in today's game, I don't really see how it can happen because, you know, pitchers, because of the large sums of money you pay for them, they're only expected to go 100 pitches, 7 innings, and you really need to put in the time and the innings and the years to get that kind of numbers. And I just don't see it happening now. Although, if you notice the last two nights, the Darvish of the Texas Rangers and the new guy on the Yankees, the Japanese pitcher.
Tanaka.
They pitch complete games, so it's a different mindset in Japan. But as far as someone striking out 5,714 batters and pitching 27 years, probably not in our lifetime, Stephen.
Well, and with the way the money is today, that's hard to imagine there's much drive to pitch for 27 years, even if you had the ability to.
Yeah, I mean, you don't need, you know.
You'd be a billionaire by then.
Well, unless you're an elite athlete like a Michael Jordan or a Muhammad Ali or a Nolan Ryan who just love the competition, you know, you're not going to stick around that long because, you don't, like you said, you don't need to. You're pretty comfortable, you know. One of the reasons Nolan stuck around as long as he did, he loved the competition primarily, and his family loved it, but, you know, he was building a little cattle empire for himself, and every year, you know, 3 or 4 more million, that could buy a few more bulls, you know.
Yeah, and I think it's ironic that Ryan is one of the players who's maybe as closely defined by his statistics as anyone, and yet I think one of the real takeaways of your book is that the stats never really tell the full story.
No, and that's where, you know, you hear there's a lot of revisionists now, Stephen, revisionist thinking among the sabermetrics groups, you know, the Bill James groups, who they try to diminish Nolan. They say, oh, he was a 500 pitcher. He only threw 324 games, but he lost 300. They don't take into account he played for inferior teams all his career. They don't take, you know, in concern, you know, that they had a pitch count in Houston, which wouldn't allow him to go further. They don't, and they take away, you know, the other elements that, you know, what you bring to the team. And when you're, you know, when you're the major league strikeout leader and you're pitching every 4 days, you bring people up. You know you got a stopper. You know you could build your staff around. You know, he elevated, Phil Garner told me this, and Don Baylor, he elevated the players around him. He elevated the team. He was a quiet role model. And these are intangibles that, you know, the players certainly know, the George Bretts and the Pete Rose, they told me, you know, they have totally respect for Nolan, and, you know. But somehow these revisionist thinkers in the sabermetrics groups don't. And that's one of the reasons why I was motivated to write this. You know, I said, you know, Nolan's a friend of mine. He's, you know, he's getting bad-mouthed by people who never even saw him, who probably couldn't field a ground ball. And it's just not true. He dominated. He dominated every game he pitched almost. And had he pitched for the New York Yankees or the Tigers or the Cardinals, he would have won 400 games. That's a quote from Whitey Herzog, who knew him better than anybody.
So when we were talking earlier, you mentioned one of the most memorable moments of his career that actually had nothing to do with particular numbers, and that was getting into this fight with Robin Ventura of the Chicago White Sox. Can you talk a little bit about that, what happened that night? And I'm curious if you think that incident added to Ryan's legend.
Oh, yeah, definitely. That's part of, you know, his mystique, his Texas mystique, the tough Texan. But, you know, and like I said before, that emanated back in 1990. The White Sox had this little guy named Craig Graybeck, 5'4". He had a home run off him in spring training, 1991, I believe, and then he pumped his arms going around the bases, which was a no-no to Nolan, and he hit him the next time. And it started a beanball war that went on for 3 years. You know, White Sox were hitting Rangers were hitting White Sox, and Nolan was always in the middle of it. And it just so happened that day in August 1993 that it culminated. You know, I asked a couple guys if there was a vendetta on Nolan. They said no, but, you know, there was definitely, there was tension. And Robin got up there the first time up. He'd hit a He hit a line drive double, I think. And I think the night before or that game, one of the Rangers got hit, and Nolan plunked him in the back. Now, Nolan says he was going inside. He was just trying to brush him back. But everybody on the White Sox, including Ventura, says, no, that was deliberate. And it was instinctual when Robin went out, but it was also built on a three-year history of a beanball war. And I guess Robin told me he went out there, and halfway out there he realized that Nolan's a pretty big guy, and he mistakenly took his helmet off, and he kind of slowed into Ryan when he got to him, and Nolan just grabbed him, put him in headlock, and started beating on him.
Yeah, he had a way of somehow running right into a headlock, which is not the position you want to be in.
No, because, you know, Nolan wrestles with cows and horses. And he's a strong guy, and he just kind of ran into that headlock, and next thing you know, Robin's getting beat up on, and then the whole team, both teams are on there, and they're both pretty mad because, like I said, there's a history of beanball wars with these guys. Interestingly enough, Robin just walked out of there, but Nolan got buried underneath the pile, and he credits Bo Jackson, who was a White Sox player back then, to help. You know, he started tearing guys off of him, and he was blacking out. He was close to, you know, to passing out underneath the pile. So actually, Ryan got the worst of it there, but history shows that it just made him a legend, a plus. You know, like George Bush said the next day in the paper, "Remember the Alamo." You know, I mean, if Nolan wasn't solidified by then, he was after that game.
So just to kind of wrap things up, Ryan eventually came back and was the president of the Rangers. Can you talk about what it meant to him to have a hand in turning the Rangers into a team that went to back-to-back World Series?
Well, I know it meant a lot. You know, he took that Rangers team. It was basically, you know, they were struggling, and he had a lot of good help with John Daniels and some younger guys. But, you know, he pulled it together. He kept, like Ron Washington told me, the managers, that he kept everybody in line, and he was there to make good decisions and guide them along. And next thing you know, the Rangers are in the World Series twice, and that meant a lot to him because it was something else besides being on the field. And it really hurt him when some of the Rangers kind of turned on him. There was a jealousy thing with him and John Daniels and the new owner, Ray Davis, and they just didn't see eye to eye, and he was edged out. And you can see now how the effect, and the Rangers aren't competitive this year as well as they should have been, but when they won the division, the first time in 19, the first time, I guess that was 2011, I'll never forget, Nolan was sitting in the front row with his grandson Jackson and Ruth, and Jackson came down for the final out, and he was in the middle between Ruth and Nolan, and there was this group hug when Velez got the last out to win the pennant, and the look on Nolan's face just says it all. It meant a lot to him, and he still likes the Rangers, but his loyalties are now with the Houston Astros. But got some great memories there with the Texas Rangers.
Our guest today, Rob Goldman, is the author of Nolan Ryan, The Making of a Pitcher. Rob, thanks so much for being with us today.
Enjoyed it, Stephen. Thanks for having me on board.
Think is produced by yours truly and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Stephen Becker. Thanks for listening and have a great day.